Hello, this is World Business Report from the BBC World Service, where we bring you the latest in money, marketing, manufacturing, and yes, much, much more. Please review us, rate us, share us wherever you can. BBC podcasts are supported by advertising.
I'm Sumi Somaskanda from the Global Story podcast, where we're looking at the latest exchange of fighting between Hezbollah and Israel. Does it bring us closer to a regional war? And will ceasefire negotiations for the Gaza conflict, the root of it all, ever come to an agreement? The Global Story brings you fresh takes and smart perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and namaste. Welcome to World Business Report from the BBC World Service. I'm Divina Gupta, and on this edition, we are doing a tech theme Wednesday. From the latest earning report of the US chip-making giant NVIDIA and the future of semiconductor industry in the US to the growing problems for the messaging platform Telegram, as its CEO, Pavel Durov, is charged over alleged criminal activity on the app in France. We're also talking about AI and jobs with the boss of the UK fintech firm Klarna.
It's critical for government to consider what could we do for the group that could be affected while at the same point in time not stop progress in the evolution of the AI.
And looking at the pros and cons of hiring older workers in the changing tech environment.
Part of the success of a factory would be having a good age range mix. And I think you need that mix. We can pass on the skills to the younger generation.
All of that coming up for you on the show, so stay with us. But first, in the last half an hour or so, the US chip-making giant NVIDIA has released the earnings from April to June. The chip maker has more than doubled its revenues, and the company has seen a huge growth over the last few years, driven by the AI boom. But it has also recently begun to face some real challenges, with production problems threatening to delay the launch of its next design of chips. Colette Kress, Executive Vice President and Chief Financial Officer of NVIDIA, spoke just a few moments ago.
Revenue of $30 billion was up 15% sequentially and up 122% year on year, and well above our outlook of $28 billion. Starting with data center. Data center revenue of $26.3 billion was a record, up 16% sequentially and up 154% year on year, driven by strong demand for NVIDIA Hopper, GPU computing, and our networking platforms.
So that is Chief Financial Officer of NVIDIA, Colette Kress. But lots of numbers there, so let's crunch them as well with Susan Schmidt, who is Head of Policy Equity and at the State of Wisconsin Investment Board. Susan, thank you for joining us. How are you looking at this report?
Well, I think this is a very strong report from NVIDIA, and it's strong in many aspects. And so I think what investors are going to take away from this as they absorb all of the detail and the data is that AI continues to be a growing theme. It is obviously something that NVIDIA is the poster child for, having brought out the chips that allowed all this to emerge. Remember that the AI craze really started with NVIDIA's earnings announcements in May of 2023. The revenue today was 122% above where they were a year ago. They exceeded analyst expectations. And I think what they're messaging here is their continued profitability. They have had issues with new chips coming online, working through the development to perfect them. I expect those chips to come onto the market without a problem, as this management is stating. And I think what we do have here is a very strong company going forward that investors are debating over how to fine-tune the valuation. So you are seeing some movement in the price, both up but down since these earnings reports ever so slightly.
It's been a roller coaster, Susan, hasn't been. This stock has been a roller coaster.
It has been. And that's one of the exciting things about it, is that AI is so unknown. People are really trying to size the future opportunity. And that's where you see this volatility in the price.
Well, NVIDIA shares have actually climbed more than 160% this year alone. But for investors, there have been nervous moments as well, as Susan just pointed out. So Susan, be with us, because let's get in someone who's been a believer. And this is Jim Woods, because he is an investor in NVIDIA. He picked up the stock when, Jim, when was it when you spotted this company?
In March of 2000, I was really had watched the IPO, didn't know a lot about the stock. The stock IPO'd in 1999, so kind of followed it, watched it for a while. And then in March 15th, 2000, I decided to go ahead and get in on it.
Yes, and it's interesting because the first public offer, the initial public offering of NVIDIA, which happened in 1999, that time, this company was completely different. It focused on computer graphics for gamers, and it was a relatively small player. So what got your attention with this company? What was it that attracted you?
Well, the thing that really attracted me at the very beginning that got me to look into it a little bit more is, as I researched the stock, I saw where Jensen Huang had been a Kentucky resident. When they immigrated over here, they spent some time in Kentucky. And since I'm located in Kentucky, that kind of piqued my interest, and I just started studying it and looking at it a whole lot more at that point in time. I thought they had a really good idea. I thought he was a really motivated individual. And as I looked at the company, looked at what they did, I just thought it would be a good place to put some money back in 2000, and it sure turned out to be a good place to put that money.
And what was that initial stock price?
Well, I bought 250 shares, and my initial investment was
$65,000. $65,000, and I think the stock was somewhere between $12 to $13. And looking at now, it's more than 900% growth. So let's go across to Tim Traukau, who is the Senior Vice President for Strategy at EdgeCore Digital Infrastructure, joining us from Colorado. Thanks so much for joining us, Tom. And help us understand what makes NVIDIA one of the most valuable companies in the world. What explains this jump?
Sure. Well, I work for a company. We build data centers for the world's largest tech companies. But so we don't While we don't purchase the NVIDIA chips directly, we build the buildings that house them. And we are a keen observer of the latest and greatest developments there. They're designed GPU chips and programming language CUDA. They've really become the backbone of what's powering all recent advances in artificial intelligence and generative AI. And I think one of the main bellwether things to watch is the fact that the largest names in tech have collectively decided that generative AI is going to power all their businesses, forward meaningfully. Just between Amazon, Microsoft, Google, Meta, and Apple alone, they're slated to spend over $200 billion in capex this year, and over $250 billion next year, and much of which is going to as many GPUs as NVIDIA will sell to them.
Which means, again, the graphic processing units. But the point here is what Susan was mentioning earlier. There is some worry about the new age chips, which is actually one model is Blackwell. And yes, it seems that it's been hit by delays. What kind of impact it will have now going forward on the company?
If there were a real substitute to NVIDIA's GPU chips that was, ready to be sold and ready to go to those same tech companies at scale, I think you'd see some hit to NVIDIA. The reality is, I think NVIDIA sold 98% of the GPUs that were made last year, and it still has a overwhelming market share in GPU sales. So, what I think that practically means is, their current generation H100s, they may sell more of those. It's almost a clearing out of the inventory. And even if there is some jitter, which I think everyone's still trying to unpack, we won't maybe know until we know. A 3-6 month delay with pent up demand for the same Same thing. They're the beneficiary on either side. It's selling more of the current generation chips or creating more pent up demand for the next generation chip while everyone's okay. waiting.
Well, Jim, you talked about how much your initial investment was, and I'm sure it's grown, as they say, that nest of money has grown a lot more. But right now, looking at this chip shortage and what we've been talking about, the delay, pardon me, of Blackwell chip, the new 8 chip, is that worrying you?
Not very much. I think the H100 and the H200s will continue to sell at a rapid pace. The one thing people haven't mentioned so far is their gross profit margin is 75%. I mean, that's just pretty much unheard of. So they're going to be able to continue to fill the void with the H100, the H200s.
The current chips.
Right, the Hopper chips, right? And when the Blackwell chips are ready, and they should be ready by the fourth quarter of this year, and particularly for 2025, they should really do well with that chip. And then they get into the Grace Blackwell. So there's a lot of pipeline for NVIDIA to take advantage of over the next year and a half at least.
Okay. And Susan, what right now we heard is also about how there are these top customers of NVIDIA, Meta, Microsoft, Amazon. Now, they have put a lot of their money in this new generation artificial intelligence. But there's been also a question about how will they monetize this AI and then the impact it will have on chip producers like NVIDIA.
That's right. And we saw some uncertainty over that as investors started to realize when those big companies started announcing their results in June and July about how much they were spending on this. And they had yet to really realize any sort of return from this capital investment. Investors suddenly realized that, wow, they're spending a lot, but it will take time before there's profitability from that. We started to see hints of it with Meta's investment report talking about how they were able to then use some of the technology to help with the AI, helping them with their ad sales. And that was a glimmer of light, but that caused some of the volatility that we saw in the markets, and particularly in these stocks in July. Right now, we're now seeing these companies continue to endorse their desire to go into AI, presumably buying and needing more chips like this. And certainly from NVIDIA's comments today, it sounds like the market will continue to be robust for some time. Investors need to be practical and realize that it takes time to see a return on the investment.
But Tom, looking at the semiconductor market itself, because now this seems to be the new age competition era as well. Countries like India, for example, have been putting a lot of money in to develop their own chips and prevent over-reliance on other companies which are outside that country. So in this kind of age of innovation and competition, how do you see NVIDIA placed?
NVIDIA, just coming off the earnings call, has made a lot of noise about selling the sovereign AI. So I think NVIDIA is trying to be in front of supporting countries' desire to lead the pack. One of the challenges is that semiconductors are some of the most advanced technology humans have ever created, and the miniaturization that's occurred, the current generation Hopper has 80 billion transistors on it, and the Blackwell will have 208 billion transistors. Supply chain for that, so through TSMC and the designs for these chips are so proprietary and bleeding edge that it's very hard to catch up. I think there's the ability. It points to Intel builds tremendous chips, with as do AMD. But the integration of it all and one of NVIDIA's leading edge sort of moats is their CUDA programming language. So,
it's pretty much ahead of its right now peers, as you're saying. But briefly then, Jim, it's also linked very closely to the American economy because it's grown in such a proportion that now we're seeing NVIDIA success or failure is also being perceived as American economy success or failure.
Yeah, that's true, but I think that's going to broaden out in the future also. There was an article today about France starting to develop more of their AI infrastructure. So it definitely has ridden the wave of the Amazons and the Googles and the Metas and the Microsofts so far. But I do think that will change. Not only sovereign AI will help bolster this, but the other countries just can't stay out of this. And as long as you have the type chip that they have and the lead that they have, people are going to have to come their way.
Are you going to keep holding those shares?
I'm probably going to continue to hold my shares for at least the foreseeable future.
Foreseeable future. All right, we'll let you go there. Jim Woods, thank you for joining us, investor and a shareholder in NVIDIA, joining us from Kentucky in the US. Tom and Susan, be with me because you're also talking about other big stories which are happening in the world of tech earlier on the BBC. Sebastian Siemiatkowski, co-founder and CEO of fintech company Klarna, spoke to my colleague on the Today program. And he was talking about AI and its impact on the tech industry.
I have been one of the people in the tech community that have tried to highlight that I believe we're going to see a dramatic impact on jobs. And I think it's too simplistic to say just new jobs will be created. And government, and I think politicians already today, should, you know, consider whether there are other alternatives of how they could support people that may be affected. I mean, maybe you can become an influencer, but it's hard to do so if you are 55 years and have worked with translations your whole year, you know, your whole life. So I think it's critical for government to consider what could we do for the group that could be affected, while at the same point in time not stop progress, because it's important that Europe and the democracies are ahead in the evolution of AI.
Now, the firm has already cut its workforce from 5,000 to 3,800 in the past year and wants to reduce that to 2,000 employees by using AI in marketing and customer service. Tom, is that what you are seeing now, the way that this industry is progressing, as we just heard Klarna CEO Sebastian there saying about how AI is inevitable and it will be now new jobs that need to be found?
Yeah, we are seeing that generally across the sector. The highest adoption for generative AI today is in the software development field. So I think it's over 78% is actively using it. And really, coding is not manual anymore. It's increasingly it's prompt engineering, and it's asking, asking a generative AI algorithm to help stitch together lines of code or create a program. And I think that that level of automation is ironically really hitting software development firms that are the same ones that have created these AI algorithms.
Tom Traugott, thank you so much for joining us, Senior Vice President for Strategy at EdgeCore Digital Infrastructure in Colorado. You're listening to World Business Report on the BBC World Service.
I'm Sumi Somaskanda from the Global Story Podcast, where we're looking at the latest exchange of fighting between Hezbollah and Israel. Does it bring us closer to a regional war? And will ceasefire negotiations for the Gaza conflict, the root of it all, ever come to an agreement? The Global Story brings you fresh takes and smart perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Now, the boss of the social media platform, Pavel Durov, has been placed under formal investigation in France as part of a probe into organized crime on the messaging app. Mr. Durov, who's 39-year-old, has not been remanded in custody but placed under judicial custody and has to pay a 5 million euro deposit. Telegram, which offers end-to-end encryption, is ranked as one of the major social media platforms. It was founded in 2013. Here's our reporter, Joe Tidy.
It all started with this shock arrest on Saturday, just outside Paris, of Pavel Durov, the billionaire founder of Telegram, who was arrested as he landed in his private jet. And the allegations against him were that his platform is basically not moderating itself enough. There is too much fraud, cybercrime, illegal activity, selling drugs and weapons, and also this allegation of child sexual abuse material not being moderated effectively. And we've last couple of days we've been wondering what's been going on with this, whether or not the French would press charges. We have just found out they have pressed charges, and they are saying to him that he has to remain in France, and there's a $5 million or it might be euros sort of bond that he has to pay, and that he's not allowed to leave the country because they are going to continue with this investigation. This wasn't some sort of a shakedown, some sort of an arrest to get him to make concessions on the app. This is a serious criminal case that they are pursuing.
And how does this all then reflect on the debate about the extent to which social media platforms should have their own way of maintaining free speech versus online safety?
Well, yeah, this is always the kind of the big conundrum when it comes to how you moderate social networks. Because, of course, if you say to someone that this is we need to moderate this type of content because it's illegal or offensive or abusive, then other people will say, well, hang on a minute, that's free speech. You're clamping down on free speech. And there's a particular element of the Telegram debate, which is particularly confusing or complex, which is the fact that Telegram has this reputation of being a very secure messaging app. It's in one way, it's a little bit like a WhatsApp or a Signal. And the other way, it's a bit like a kind of Twitter or an Instagram, because it's both private messaging and also kind of public channels as well. But the difficulty with that argument is that Telegram actually, although it has this reputation of being secure, it's not that secure. It's nowhere near as secure as, say, for example, Signal or WhatsApp, because by default, the messages that are sent and the channels that are created on Telegram are not end-to-end encrypted, which is the kind of the best form of encryption and security and privacy that you can get on a commercial product. So when people say, oh, this is an attack on free speech, you're going after encrypted messaging apps, stopping people from talking in private, that kind of doesn't really stand up, because most of the chats on Telegram aren't that form of encryption. They are kind of easily readable by the likes of Telegram and law enforcement. And the difficulty, the issue that Telegram has is that it's not about how secure the app is, it's about how safe the app is. And what prosecutors in France are arguing is that the app is allowing too much criminality to take place on its platform.
So in terms of those charges against Pavel Durov now, what happens next?
I was wondering whether or not we would see this type of action, because when the French arrested him, I think it was 96 hours that they had to either charge him or release him. And I had a feeling that they would be charging him. But obviously, you cannot hold someone like that under these kind of allegations in prison. So I imagine that what's going to happen now is that there will be a very long and protracted legal case whereby Pavel Durov stays in France, almost like a house arrest. He'll be under bail. He has to go and visit the police station twice a week. And it'll be a long and it'll be a very high profile case. I don't know how it's going to end, of course. Someone like Pavel Durov has obviously got a huge amount of support and a lot of money behind him. So I imagine that the court case will be lengthy and very, very complicated. But we will see what will be an unprecedented situation of a tech platform CEO going to court about not what he's doing, but what's being done on his app.
Unprecedented case also in France. That's BBC's Joe Tidy talking about Telegram CEO Pavel Durov's latest in the case. Now, we've been looking at the impact of aging in the workplace this week here on World Business Report. And one of the problems that the UK faces as it tries to breathe more life into its economy is an aging population. There are about 67 million people in the country, and nearly 15 million of them are over the age of 50 and economically inactive. And that figure is increasing. But some companies are going out of their way to recruit these older workers, but also comes with a new age technology. So the BBC's Simon Browning has been finding out more.
Sewing. Snipping. Steaming. Here at home retailer Dunelm's made-to-order curtain factory in Leicester, in the heart of the UK, more than half of the team is over 50. A seamless blend of youth and technical experience. With no sign of retirement, Ali and Mags want to keep using half a century of learned skills.
68 next month.
And you, Ali?
I will be 65 in about 4 weeks.
She's a good worker, Ali?
Yeah, she's a great worker. Everybody loves her.
part of the success of a factory would be having a good age range mix. And I think you need that mix. We can pass on the skills to the younger generation.
A quarter of those who work for Dunelm are older workers, those over 50. It's almost 3,000 people. They actively recruit this age group, targeting them on Facebook and in job centres. It appears to be working. Amanda Cox, Dunelm's stores and people director, says the retailer is growing and opening new stores, a rare achievement.
We have a very flexible approach to different types of shifts. I've had colleagues chat to me in stores or in here, and they'll go, I'm retiring. And I'll go, we really don't want you to retire. Have you considered staying on in a seasonal contract so that, you know, you can just come in for less weeks of the year, but it still keeps you connected.
There are 11.1 million economically active over 50s in the UK economy. That's either in a job or actively looking for one. That's up 320,000 in the last 5 years since before the pandemic. But there's 14.8 million economically inactive workers over 50, and that's up a million in the last 5 years. Getting some of those back to work would be a big boost for the UK economy.
With so many workers out of the jobs market, many have challenges getting back in, as Stuart Lewis, founder and CEO of Restless, a digital community for the over 50s, tells me.
We often talk about this cohort of people as being the sandwich generation. So often they will be primary carer for their elderly parents who are often in their 80s or 90s. Sometimes they'll still have dependent children and teenagers at home. And that can have a big impact on their ability to navigate work.
Come in. Well, this is my home, which is also my workplace.
In rural Buckinghamshire, in the south of England, Kay Flannery teaches students from around the world English at home, offering bed and board.
In the evenings, we often sit round here and watch a film on TV or some interesting sport or documentary or something like that. And this is the table where we have our lessons. This is our kitchen. And Tony and I prepare food here for students. Students often love to help us prepare British food. And they also very often love to produce something from their hometown or something. So we've had the most brilliant Japanese food, Italian food, a food from everywhere. Yeah, job satisfaction is really important. And I think having some sort of structure for the week. The income, I don't usually think about that too much, but it's always good to have. But mostly for me, it's just meeting a whole load of interesting people and having interesting things to research a bit.
With almost 900,000 job vacancies in the UK economy, drawing on the skills of the UK's older workers could be a boost for much-wanted economic growth.
Simon Browning there, and going back to Susan Schmidt. Susan, I was looking at the after-hours dealing in the US. It seems that tech stocks are looking at some sort of fall.
They are, but they're all coming in ever so slightly. Remember that NVIDIA was a very big, much-watched event today. People are digesting the information from that call, and tech stocks are seldom the same price for very long.
Thanks, Susan Schmidt, head of public equity at the State of Wisconsin Investment Board on World Business Report. Thank you for joining us.
I'm Sumi Somaskanda from the Global Story Podcast, where we're looking at the latest exchange of fighting between Hezbollah and Israel. Does it bring us closer to a regional war? And will ceasefire negotiations for the Gaza conflict, the root of it all, ever come to an agreement? The Global Story brings you fresh takes and smart perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.